Good morning, church. Happy Father's Day. I know I'm thinking about my father and grandfathers, and especially about this church this morning and the many fathers and elders that we have here, the mentors for all of us. I send you greetings this morning from Pastor Jin and from the team. If you're on Facebook and following them, you see some of the photos. They're having a wonderful time right now. They've been in Seoul. I know they're going to be going to visit Pastor Jin's family, and then they'll be going to the southern part of Korea. Things are going well. Pastor Jin preached two sermons this morning, so his sabbatical is off to a great start. he's preaching at an English ministry there at church of an old friend, as he shared last week, and I know he was really looking forward to that. So continue to keep them in your prayers, and especially for Pastor Jin on the sabbatical, that he actually does get some real rest and renewal, both in Korea and as he comes back. I also just want to remind you that throughout the summer, we're going to be having different preachers preaching every week. We have so many preachers in this church that for over 3 months, nobody will preach twice. So I am really looking forward to that. I have a sense that they have set the bar low and keep on moving up as we go throughout the summer. Who's next week? Is Jimber here? Don't pay too close attention to that. But I'm really looking forward to hearing from everybody. I think it's going to be a real gift this summer, and I'm happy to be here. And I'm especially happy to be sharing today, my first Sunday, with this congregation, preaching as an ordained minister. And I just feel so much gratitude I feel a lot of gratitude, and as I shared in the ordination service, a sense of responsibility and a real challenge to be faithful with what you have entrusted with me and in ordained ministry. And I know that we all do ministry in various ways. But I wear this stole today to remind me of my groundedness in this congregation. This was given to me by Sugi and Sunbeck and Tao, who made it. But it represents for me this whole church and all I've learned over the last 10 years. So I appreciate that, and I appreciate all of you. This is also a service I've been looking forward to because it's our VBS Sunday, and it's always such a celebratory service. It's Father's Day, and it's also a baptism. And so there's a lot of things to celebrate, and that's even reflected in the title that I chose for the text on Thursday when I passed that on. The Kingdom of Heaven has come near. And this is to be a sermon, actually, of testimonies. And I feel that, and it is a service of celebration. But we also live in this society and in this world. And I, as many of us I know, and Ebony has already testified to this, I was shook to the core on Friday. I know that this was entirely predictable. I know many of us were awaiting the verdict that came. And nevertheless, it opens up deep, deep wounds and traumas in this country for the Black community, but for all of us who participate in the sin, the original sin of white supremacy in this country. Yesterday was the anniversary of the Mother Emanuel AME church shooting in Charleston, the 9 victims in that church as well. So this is also a weekend right now where we are being confronted again and again and having to wrestle with and sit with and stare at the effect of the demon of white supremacy on this society and how it continues to manifest itself. And just a few words on this before I get into the text. I know that this verdict, there has been many over the last few years that have come to public consciousness, Sandra Bland and Eric Garner and Michael Brown and Tamir Rice and Elton, Freddie Gray, Trayvon Martin. I mean, there's such a long list, and we can go on and on, of those where no conviction was made for Black men and women who were murdered. This one's difficult, one, because it's local. We have a St. Anthony police officer who was involved, but also because Philando Castile did everything He could have. He did everything right. We know about all the times he was pulled over throughout his short life for really random things that were just basically racial profiling. In this case, we know it was a very blatant case of racial profiling by the testimony of the officer himself. We know that he was licensed, legal to carry, and he said in a very calm voice, right up front, Philando Castillo did, that he had a gun. And we know that he reached for his wallet when asked. And in 74 seconds, he was shot through extrajudicial murder on the spot. As a church, we speak out against these things. We name these things. We grieve and lament. And I know many of us are angry. I know we're lamenting. And I know that we're tired. And yet this is something that we have to keep coming together to address and to speak about, because this is still with us. The reality is right now that blackness itself is criminal in this country. That's what this verdict means. There's been many verdicts. It's just incontrovertible right now. Blackness itself is criminal. That's why there is never a conviction. Because if there is any sort of reasonable suspicion that a person is a threat to one's safety, to others, then it's not based on 2020. It's based on in the moment when these juries decide whether or not that was justified. And because blackness itself is enough to raise suspicion, because of hundreds of years of propaganda through media, through Hollywood, through education, for all kinds of reasons, and because whiteness has presented itself as innocent, inherently, and good, and all institutions like the police are also presented as inherently innocent and good with maybe a few bad apples, and the law is presented as innocent and good, we have to accept it. And so because of this, it continues to happen, and it will happen again, and we have to name it, and we have to figure out what our faith says about this, and we have to learn to read the biblical text through this lens. Because when we open the Bible, we have 1,700 years of the text being sanitized and removing all of this from the text. But it is right there in our pages, as we will see today. And we have fresh eyes again to see what Jesus is engaging and what we as a church, as the people of God, are called to as peacemakers, as witnesses in the society that we live in. Our text today is Matthew 10. I read it initially as just kind of a simple summary of Jesus' ministry. Cure the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons. And we believe in all of that, and we follow Jesus because of this. And we ourselves as a church seek to do this work. And I know that there is a history of reading this in mostly religious ways, and this is religious. But what I want us to see today is that Jesus' ministry of engaging the poverty around him, of healing illness, of addressing trauma, and of exercising demon possession is also through and through political. We talked a lot about this, gosh, I think it was back in February now. For those of you who are in the Underground Institute, I just want to give a little bit of background again to ground us here and to get into this. The biblical tradition begins as the spirituals, black spirituals remind us, as the black church has reminded us and taught us how to read the text again, the biblical tradition begins with the Exodus. It begins with the Exodus cry. And the Exodus cry for Yahweh to deliver a people from bondage and slavery is then enshrined in the law of Israel, in looking out for the widows, the orphans, the resident aliens, the poor. That is the test of the health of the community to the degree that the whole community is flourishing, the whole community is cared for, the whole community is seen as kin and as family. We know that Israel herself did not always live up to this, and the prophets emerge to call a people back. And Jesus enters in the midst of this prophetic messianic tradition to call a people back to the way of Yahweh. In the midst of, and this is important, in the midst of first century Roman occupied Palestine. There is a political context to all of this. Jesus is reaching deep in the tradition, as we will see, to raise up this ancient communal wisdom to remind a people who they are amidst crushing Roman imperial occupation, something that the temple itself in Jerusalem is complicit within through the way that Roman colonial power operated in that space. But make no mistake, this is a space of colonial violence. It is a space of colonial trauma. It is a space that is a police state as Jesus is doing this ministry. And Jesus is ministering in Galilee. And Galilee, of all places in Palestine, if you look at a map of Palestine and how it stretches from the north to the south, with Jerusalem being down at the south in the region of Judea, Galilee is up towards the north. It's not far from the border of Syria, where Rome had four legions of troops stationed, ready to respond in an instant. And they often did. So in 40 to 37 BCE, as Herod, who became Herod the Great, a client king of this region, was consolidating his power, he swept through this region of Galilee, and it was brutal in terms of the conquest and what he did in that region. When he died in 4 BCE, and there was uprisings because of the brutality of his rule, and people were demanding a more just rule in that region, again, these Roman troops swept through that region and devastated Galilee. They burned villages, they executed people all over the place. This continued again and again in this region of Galilee. Herod himself, who ruled from 37 to 4 BCE, he was a client king. And he was a client of the Roman emperor. He totally bought in to the Roman propaganda. He sought to do continual favors for the Roman emperor. He built Caesarea. He rebuilt the Jewish temple in Hellenistic style. He extracted tons of resources and revenue from the countryside through tribute and taxes and the temple and tithes and all kinds of things, but it was crushing. And when it wasn't paid, the tax collectors were fully within their right to use physical punishment to the point of death in these regions. So Herod was known as somebody who himself operated a police state in this region. And we know that Jesus is born shortly after this under the reign of Herod's son, Herod Antipas, who himself started building up these imperial cities like Sepphoris and Tiberias, and also extracting from the people through a very devastating rule in the region of Galilee. This is the context of our text. Basically, Rome had two strategies. One is persuasion. You build these really fabulous imperial cities, and there's all kinds of amenities. There's games, there's festivals, the gymnasium, there's the theater. Anybody who's a citizen of Rome gets to benefit and live well. And for those that don't follow along, typically those who are being scapegoated, who are being expressed and exploited for the resources being funneled into the city, like in Galilee, the way of Rome's rule is that of terror, of terrorizing a people into submission, making examples of a few so that everybody gets in line and doesn't dare question or think about revolting to this rule in their land. And above it all is law. Roman law was lifted up to the point of being deified, to the point of being sacred. Nobody questions Roman law because that's what brings the Pax Romana. And you just kind of look away at what's going on in the countryside. In this, Jesus emerges in Galilee. And he goes about to all the cities and the villages, and he teaches in their synagogues. The synagogues are an ancient space. They're a space of political assembly. They're a space of religious observance, but religion and ethics in this place are one and the same. How do we love our neighbor well? How do we pool and share our resources? How do we make sure that nobody falls behind, falls too deep into debt? How do we take care of one another? This is something that in this region, they, through continual occupation of various empires, was broken up, but they kept trying to return to and recover this tradition. And Jesus is somebody within the tradition seeking to bring the people back. And so he goes around teaching in the synagogues, recognizing the trauma and the brokenness and the fractured communities that are around because of all that has happened. And he proclaims the good news of the kingdom. Basileia, an alternative, is a very, I mean, in the Greek here, it is a direct counter to the kingdom that Rome is offering. Preaches the good news, the euangelion of the kingdom for the people, to cure every disease and to heal every sickness, which in and of itself is a drawing people back into community, because the way the law functioned at this time, if you were sick, if you had a disease, you were you're basically criminalized. You have to continue to pay tithes to the temple, make your route, you're thrust into poverty, you're separated through the purity codes from the community. There's a whole list of things that basically turns you into a criminal, and a scapegoat, and you're just left out on your own if you're sick, trapped in this ongoing sort of slavery, debt bondage, prison to keep on sending revenue to the temple. This is how the system worked. It is these people that Jesus comes to and offers healing. And he invites them back into the community. He organizes the people. He teaches them the ways, and he seeks to bring shalom, peace, healing, to restore identity, to bring back agency to the people who are there. He has compassion for them, and he invites the people, and he invites disciples to journey with him to do this critical but difficult work, the beginning of discipleship, the early origins of the church. And then in chapter 10, we read, "Then Jesus summoned his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to cure every disease and every sickness." One thing that Matthew doesn't mention here, but we have it in the other synoptics, starting with Mark, is that he gathers them up on the mountain, and he appoints the 12. And everybody sees and reads this as a direct allusion to the Mount Sinai tradition, after the people are taken out of Exodus, taken from their bondage to reconstitute themselves as a people, to bring together 12 tribes and to live a different way. And Jesus here, through the power of this symbolism and the gathering of the 12, is signaling something to everybody around. He's regathering the people. He is creating a new community. This is going to be a community of love and of healing. It's also going to be a community of resistance. It's going to be one where the people find their health, wholeness, healing, agency again. And to do so requires exorcism. Because in a context like this, with trauma like this, with propaganda like this, with the Roman Empire through the temple drilling in the ideology of that time, including Roman militarism that is symbolized in Legion, we see cast out in one of Jesus' healings, in the casting out of Legion, is a casting out of the demonic imperial spirits of the day to liberate and to free the people so that they can live again. And this is the mission that the disciples are called on. They're called to live deeply into the true authentic tradition that has been destroyed, that has been co-opted by temple leadership. And so Jesus sends them out, and he tells them to go nowhere among the Gentiles, enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. This is an emphasis that's really strong in Matthew's text. For Matthew, Jesus' ministry is about regathering, healing, walking with, having compassion, bringing identity, as I have said, to his own people first. We see this opened up by the end of the text. We have examples with the Syrophoenician woman, with the centurion. There's many examples where Jesus opens it up beyond that. But Jesus' primary ministry is to his own people in the sight of colonial trauma. And he says, go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and as you go, proclaim the good news. The kingdom of heaven has come near. Cure the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons. And then he tells them this. Basically, take nothing with you. Take no gold, silver, copper, no bag. In Matthew's text, they don't even get to bring sandals. I think Mark lets them bring sandals. But basically, go out, make yourselves completely vulnerable and dependent on the community around you, showing trust, showing an assumption of kinship, showing a belief up front that we're family. And then ask them to receive you in that way. And if they receive you, share your peace with them. Share the good news with them. Share everything that you have, everything that I have taught you. Teach them these things. Gather them together and to minister to one another. And in doing so, in this sort of organizing and pastoral ministry and all of this, we're going to slowly rebuild a community in Galilee. And then what if you go to a place where they don't receive you? Where they view you with suspicion up front? Where there is no sense of kinship up front. The text says, shake off the dust from your feet as you leave that house or town. Move on, the work is too urgent. Give them a chance. If they're not going to receive you, if they're not going to care for you, if they're not going to receive you as Abraham and Sarah in Genesis 15, 16 received the three visitors who turned out to be Yahweh by lavishing them with gifts, as is the ancient way in this context, and bowing before them, carrying them, treating them as royalty in their midst. If they're not going to receive you in this way, then move on. Others will. And you need to continue to do the work. And then it closes with, truly I tell you, it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah on the day of judgment than for that town. Sodom and Gomorrah, I know the history of interpretation with this text. The church has long connected this to equating sin, saying that it has to do with a sin of homosexuality. Sodom and Gomorrah is not about the sin of homosexuality. That is not what the text is saying. Sodom and Gomorrah is a judgment upon the towns for this failure to receive guests. It is a failure to show hospitality as expected, and because of that, judgment is brought upon those towns. This whole text is about the kingdom of heaven. It is about what things look like when the kingdom of heaven comes near. It is about Jesus' embodiment of the kingdom of heaven. Heaven not being a platonic, otherworldly sort of place that the souls and spirits kind of drift off to when we die, that's better than this fallen material world. That is not the framework here. Heaven is the place where God, where Yahweh is present and reigns. And it's evidenced in the life of the people, in the way that the people relate to and care for one another, the way the people stand up, resist, and challenge every single force around that tries to bring death, destruction, despair, exploitation. That is the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven is good news, and it is a challenge, and it is a critique, and it is a judgment. And it is a judgment where hospitality is not shown, where kinship is not acknowledged, where there is a break in our relations with everyone and with the land and the earth around as family. When that is in place, then there is judgment that comes. I hear in this text, as I hope you do too, a lot of parallels and a connection to where we are right now as a society. I started with talking about Philando Castile. I started talking about Mother Emmanuel AME, who, by the way, was a church that opened its doors and showed hospitality to a white visitor in a context where there was a lot of trauma, and yet hospitality was shown anyway. This country, again and again, the history of this country is one of receiving hospitality from the native inhabitants, the indigenous peoples of this land, and then violating that from the start. And then bringing people over to work the land as slaves, and even after the Emancipation Proclamation, which we celebrate tomorrow, Juneteenth, even after that, continuing to break kinship, to break any offer of hospitality, of graciousness, even of forgiveness, when we're not to that point yet because reparations have not been made, continually breaking hospitality in that way. What I see in this text is good news, an offer of healing, reaching out to arms, Yahweh joining in deep, deep solidarity with those who are continually victimized through imperial powers and through the dominant ideology of the day, which today is white supremacy. It is a good news and a seeking to gather and offer healing through Jesus' ministry. And it is a deep judgment on all those towns around, and especially if we extrapolate on those Roman cities, Caesarea, on Sepphoris, on Tiberias, and on Rome itself, for a continual failure to show and offer hospitality. This is a beautiful text, and it's a hard text, and it's a text we have to listen to. It's a text I have to listen to and wrestle with. And one of the things that I just kept thinking about as I was reading this text, there's trauma, and there's trauma for the Galileans in this region. I also wonder about the citizens of these Roman cities. I wonder if they knew. I wonder if they knew how their games and the gymnasium were funded. I wonder if they questioned the festivals with the food that kept coming through, the produce. I wonder if they wondered about the palaces that were all around them and a few of the benefits they were offered as Roman citizens. I wondered if they are aware of what was happening in Galilee. I wonder, as they lived off the exploitation of this land, if they knew the terror that was visited regularly on those in the villages. I wonder if they offered their support to a community organizer and a pastor and a prophet like Jesus as he moved around, and as he took actions like shutting down the temple, not that different from MLK's move to shut down a freeway, or what's going on today in these protests, shutting down a freeway to bring attention to what is happening, a minor temporary inconvenience to draw attention to this entire unjust exploitative system. I wonder if these people, these citizens in these villages, saw that and got what was happening. If they cared about what happened in 40 to 37 BCE, or in 4 BCE in Galilee, as Rome brought its legions through and everything that followed. I wonder if they were aware of all the extrajudicial killings that occurred all around with regularity to remind the people to stay in place, that Rome was in charge. Are they so caught up in the propaganda of Roman supremacy, of Roman theology, of the Pax Romana, to actually believe that Roman law equals justice? Do they believe that with all the evidence to the contrary around? Do we believe that? Do I believe that? Am I going to automatically default to the overall goodness of American law, of American police, of the courts, make the argument that those that I know are good? And by the way, one of the things that I have worked on hard over the last year, our church has worked on, Pastor Jen and myself and others at different times, is building a relationship with the Columbia Heights Police. And we have built a very deep relationship with them, one where we can speak honestly about everything that I'm saying here. Everything that I've said here is something that myself and Pastor Jen have also said to our Columbia Heights police. And we're fortunate that right now they receive it. And they appreciate the relationship that we have. And they also know that we're watching, that we have relationships throughout the community and we're paying attention. And we're holding them accountable for the way that they treat everybody. I can say that modern policing, at its core DNA, is racist, just as a lot of modern institutions are, while also entering into a relationship and advocating for the Columbia Heights Police Department. Just like a number of denominations are racist to the core, this past week we had a situation with the Southern Baptists where they hesitated and paused and had to delay a couple of days to actually denounce the alt-right and white supremacy. And they came around because the blowback was so great. But this, and it's not, I'm not just talking about the Southern Baptists here. I mean, this is at the heart of our denominations, including the PCOSA, Assemblies of God. Go through the list. It's there. Dylann Roof was raised in the Lutheran Church. We have to wrestle with what is at the core DNA of all of these institutions, including especially modern policing in our courts, because of the immediate impact that they can have and the way that they function to protect property for some while warning and terrorizing others. And we have to name it and we have to say it, and we can't be self-conscious or get plagued by guilt if we benefit from this. We have to name it. I get it. My instinct, very, very deep. It is my instinct. And I've worked on developing my consciousness, but in my body, it's two things. One, it's a fear of blackness. Immediate. And I have to work to quickly move beyond that deep level gut instinct that has been socialized into me to realize that that is not the case. And that's that instinct that actually is connected to all of these, that is playing out in all of these police departments and with these individuals as well. They just happen to have a gun. And protection from the courts. But the other thing is I'm quick to assume overall, I'm talking instinct here, not what I know, the overall innocence and goodness of our legal system and the police, and to defer and to be obedient and to comply. I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago, a year and a half ago, I went to the Mall of America. This was during the after the protest following Jamar Clark's killings. And I went to the Mall of America to stand witness to what was going on, along with hundreds, thousands of other people from around the city. We quickly moved to the airport. We got to the airport off the train, and as soon as we got off, there was a police officer standing at the steps, standing like this, and he said, "You cannot pass. You cannot pass." Every single person of color that was in that group went straight past him, went right up the escalator, right past the doors. Almost every single white person, myself included, we froze. We totally froze. At one point, somebody came to the top of the escalator, one of the organizers, and said, "What are you all doing? He has no power here to tell you to stop. Walk, run past him." And everybody was frozen. And finally, and I wish it was me, but it was not. I don't know if she's here. Our own Sonia Olson was the first to break through and to run past. And then everybody else ran past, and he did nothing. But this is something very, very deep in terms of even when there is blatant cases of injustice and when there needs to be protest and there needs to be the cleansing of a temple, that we freeze. The fear is so deep in us, the automatic deferring compliance with authority in a totally rotten, unjust system is automatic. And we're very quick to question or assume complicity or guilt or whatever on the part of those who are victimized in this society, especially those who are black and those who are Native, the historical victims in the society, and there are many more people of color. Underneath it all, I have a sense for these citizens of Caesarea, of Tiberias, of Sepphoris, there's also trauma. they were also once a conquered people. They were a people from the ta ethne, from the nations. These are the people that Paul addresses in his ministry and calls them to the way of the cross that Jesus modeled and himself gives up his life. Paul was also not this political quietist that we make him out to be because of Romans 13. That was not Paul. Paul gathers these people who may be citizens now, and out of their trauma, long repressed, long buried, something they can't even touch or access anymore, because they're caught up in the privileges of Rome and they've turned a deaf ear and they've shut off everything else that's going around because they don't want to touch that. Paul recognized, and I think Jesus also got, that there was a deeper trauma underneath, and underneath that trauma, buried way down, was a deeper humanity. The trauma here is fear and it's guilt. It's fear because of all the destruction that has been done in the name of whiteness, and it is a deeper guilt and shame that, because we don't know how to deal with it and face it, is we project it in all kinds of ways, whether apathy or violence or anything in between, we project it. I believe that as Jesus shows us in this text, I know, and I've learned this through this congregation, there is a need for the historical victims of colonial trauma, imperial rule, to come together on their own and work on healing and trauma. I think Jesus is doing that work. I also know and believe that there is a place and a need for, in our context, white people or those drawn into and socialized into whiteness to also come together and start to do this work, to dig deep and to explore this trauma, to unearth it, and then to use it in creative ways filled with energy and vitality to gather back together, to love, to care, to show compassion, and also to challenge and to fight for a better society, a better world, to fight on behalf of life. I believe that both those are necessary. I also believe and know and have learned that through this church that it is an amazing thing when we can gather together, bear with one another, bear each other's burdens as we're doing right now, and teach each other across the differences and across the divisions that this society has imposed upon us. And every time something like this happens, we're gonna feel it again. And there's gonna be a need for those spaces, and that there's, and then I also just feel a tremendous amount of gratitude as I'm able to come in and continually explore deep in my own humanity and see that drawn out of others around. I am so, so grateful for this church. I'm grateful for our children, for the way that they led us this morning, and the way that we're going to be led again through this slideshow. I'm grateful that they may not have that deep instinct within. I'm hopeful that I still have to struggle against, and I know many of us have to struggle against, because they are growing up in a community like this. I pray that we are moving beyond, despite all evidence to the contrary, making movement, challenging the demonic thing that possesses us called white supremacy, the very thing Jesus is casting out here, so that we can continue to gather and continue to go deeper and share and pool all that we have with one another. So thank you. Thank you for a space where we can all be baptized deeply into this tradition, this way of Jesus, and may we continue to encourage and spur one another on into this critical and important work while being attentive to the world that we live in around and speaking when we must. Amen. Amen. Let's pray.